Hey, Grandpa, you never really explained why they were fighting here in the first place.
Well, geography predestines history along this Lakes to Locks passage, Marshall.
What do you mean?
These waterways were like a superhighway leading right into the heart of the colonies. Indians were the first to use them for transportation, and Europeans followed suit, establishing forts as they claimed their territory, because literally control of the interconnected waterway meant control of the continent.
I guess I never thought of it like that.
And they had been fighting for a while. The French and Indian War, known as the Seven Years' War in Europe and Canada, was the last in a series of wilderness wars that took place in North America. It started as European conflict between the French, the English, and their allies, then boiled over into the New World.
So this was the hot spot.
Right. But at the end of the French and Indian War, France gave control of French Canada to the British.
Then the British had control of the lake, right?
Yes, and they needed to secure their hold of it. That cost them a lot of money. Britain's King George did a pretty savvy thing. He offered land grants in the New World as a reward to his soldiers for gallant service to the crown. It was a great incentive to encourage enlistment during the war.
I bet he also wanted good military guys here in case he needed them after the war was over.
Yes, good point. The king made sure he could defend the waterway in a heartbeat, since the enemies from the French and Indian War were still close by.
Hey, Grandpa, I have two questions. How many years between the wars? And did Benedict Arnold fight in the French and Indian War?
There were only 12 years between the wars. So the young soldiers fighting in the French and Indian War were the officers leading soldiers in the Revolutionary War. Burgoyne, Carleton, and most of the other characters in our story knew each other. Sometimes friends, sometimes foe. Personal relationships were forged over years of service.
And Arnold?
Arnold was just a little older than you at the outbreak of the French and Indian War. He had a rebellious spirit and tried running away to join the fighting more than once, but never saw action during that conflict.
You mean he was about my age and was trying to go to war? Life sure was a lot different back then.
He also had a very different upbringing than you. Arnold was born to a respectable family of New England merchants in Connecticut. When he was young, he attended a fancy school and was bound for Yale. But his father was a drunk and lost the family fortune.
Ouch.
Arnold was likely deeply affected by his father's disgrace and became an unruly teen who spent a great deal of time playing with children, many of whom were from local Indian tribes.
So not only did he have a fighting spirit, he knew how to fight like an Indian?
Yeah, maybe. However, he also had another side. Arnold's mother placed him in the employ of a well-to-do apothecary, where he got a taste for the finer things in life.
What's an apothecary?
Sort of like an early pharmacist. Arnold served as an apprentice, and when he completed his service with the doctor, he opened his own shop. He became a successful businessman and eventually was able to purchase a ship and become a merchant.
Oh, all right. So this is how Arnold knew how to command a ship. When does this turn into a revolution?
In that short 12-year period before the American Revolution, the relationship between the colonists and the mother country changed dramatically. As I said earlier, the French and Indian War was expensive for the British.
All right, okay. I got it from here, Grandpa. The British needed money, so they taxed the colonists. We cover this in social studies. There was the Boston Tea Party.
Hold on there. You're on to something, but that is only part of the story. The British started imposing taxes on the colonists only a year after the end of the French and Indian War.
But Grandpa, why were the colonists put up with it in the first place? What was England doing for them?
The Brits had a case. North America was still a really dangerous place. Britain maintained troops and outposts throughout the continent to protect the colonists. Aside from the French, the Spanish also had claimed territory in North America. Yet it was the Indians lurking close by in the wooded landscape that the colonists feared the most.
Oh, I just got a feeling. The thought that a conflict could happen any minute. I can't imagine having to live like that.
Yeah, but remember, many of these colonists were settlers and veterans that had lived through earlier conflicts. They paid taxes to the colonial governors for the state militia. They never paid taxes directly to the king. The king thought that the colonists needed someone to watch their backs and cover his debts. so he needed to do everything he could to get money back to England.
So this was clearly a move to raise money for the king.
Exactly. Throughout the 18th century, Britain controlled the markets by collecting a tax on imports and exports, called a tariff. But it was rarely collected. After the war, the king pushed for stronger enforcement.
Well, that makes sense. I'm sure it made some people upset, but is that enough to spark a revolution?
No, Marshall. The outrage to the tariffs were mostly limited to New England merchants. That is, until the Stamp Act was passed in 1765. The Stamp Act created a tax on every single piece of printed paper, such as legal documents, licenses, and even newspapers. Merchants, lawyers, and particularly newspaper printers throughout the colonies were hugely impacted. Those newspapers quickly became the voice of opposition.
Wow, taxing every single piece of paper? That is hard to imagine. I bet that a whole lot of people were upset.
Exactly.
Wait, but it's 1765. The revolution doesn't start for another 10 years. In Mr. Doyle's class, I thought the revolution came on quicker and more dramatically.
People didn't automatically turn their backs on the crown the second things got tough. Things take a bit of time to develop. Seeds of unrest need to be planted, and people need to come together and find a common voice. That was beginning to happen in seaport cities like Boston and New York City, the hubs for merchants like Arnold.
No taxation without representation!
Oh, I've heard that in class, but I don't really get it. Aren't all British citizens subjects of the king?
No, Marshall. The British government was a constitutional monarchy. Ultimately, the king held all the power, but it was up to the representatives of the House of Lords and the House of Commons to raise taxes.
Oh, so the colonists were upset because they were being taxed without their consent.
It's much more than that, though. Their rights as British subjects were being violated. In response to the Stamp Act, the Sons of Liberty were formed, and planned protests were organized in New York and Boston.
I bet Arnold was a part of that mob, all set to revolt against the king. Give me liberty or give me death, right?
He was. And within a year, continued protests forced the king to remove troops from their frontier posts to keep peace in the cities. Due to the rising tensions, the Stamp Act was repealed. The colonists rejoiced, and soon after, the Sons of Liberty were disbanded.
So it isn't really a crisis yet?
Not really at this point. There were many people living here who owed their lives and livelihood to the crown. There were family ties, political allegiances, and mutual interests. But most importantly, most colonists were just trying to eke out a way of life and had very little interest in the affairs of government.
So when does it turn into a revolution?
It's an evolving process. The king asserted his right to tax the colonies. The colonists would riot, protest, and boycott British goods. As the violence escalated, additional troops would come to occupy the major cities. Arnold was in the West Indies when tensions between Boston residents and British troops escalated into the Boston Massacre. Listen to what Arnold had to say.
Good God! Are the Americans all asleep and tamely yielding up their liberties? Or are they all turned philosophers? I am afraid of the latter, and that we shall all soon see ourselves as poor and as much oppressed as ever a heathen philosopher was.
The final straw for the king was when a group of protesters dressed as Indians boarded a ship and threw all the tea overboard.
You mean the Boston Tea Party? So the American Revolution really started over some tea?
After the Boston Tea Party, King George decided that the colonists needed to be punished. So he passed a series of acts to discipline the unruly New England colonists. He shut down the port of Boston and disbanded local government.
So now the war begins.
It was in the spring of 1775 that the first shots rang out at the battles of Lexington and Concord. Lieutenant General John Burgoyne was among the British officers dispatched to quell the rebellion.
Oh, he's the guy that got cut out by Carleton back at Valcour, and his wife died, right?
Yes, but we started the story in the middle. So now let's go back and find out how Burgoyne got here in the first place. He's the guy, the famous British general whose path we're following. Okay, you're on, Marshall. Use your device and rustle up some background on our guy, Burgoyne.
Okay, he was born to the family of Captain John Burgoyne, but wait, he was really thought to be the illegitimate child of Lord Bingley, a wealthy aristocrat. And when Lord Bingley died in 1731, he inherited his estate. He had been given a proper military education and was able to purchase an officer's commission. Purchase an officer's commission?
Yes, that was the way they did it in Europe. Ranked positions were reserved for people who could afford it.
Then he eloped with Lady Charlotte, daughter of the Earl of Derby.
Against the Earl's will, I might add.
Ah, so he was rebellious too, like Arnold. Okay, so Burgoyne sold his commission and they moved to France. After the birth of their child, they eventually reconciled with Lord Derby and he was able to purchase a new commission. He then went to Portugal during the Seven Years' War. Do you think he was a good soldier?
Yes, a good leader. Innovative, ambitious, and well-liked by his men.
It says here that he was elected to the House of Commons in Parliament. Get this, he was a playwright and active in British society too.
Yes, quite the bon vivant. He headed off to Boston in 1775.
I guess he had a share of enemies too, because some people called him vain and ambitious, with a half understanding that was worse than none. Now as I scroll down, I see pictures of Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen capturing Fort Ticonderoga. Was this at the same time?
Yes, a new provincial government began to form and each state raised its own militia. Arnold began the war as a captain in Connecticut's militia, a position to which he was elected in March 1775. A month after the outbreak of hostilities at Lexington and Concord, his company marched northeast to Boston and proposed to the Massachusetts Committee of Safety a mission to seize Fort Ticonderoga, which he believed to be poorly defended. Arnold was given a commission as a colonel in the Massachusetts militia and dispatched to Fort Ticonderoga.
Ooh, promoted from captain to colonel in a month. Go Arnold!
He immediately rode to Castleton, Vermont, where he ran into Ethan Allen. Arnold had the orders but lacked the men, whereas Allen had the men but lacked the orders. So they decided to go together. Arnold and Allen captured the unsuspecting troops at the fort in May 1775.
And they did it. Burgoyne's not the only ambitious guy in this story.
Exactly. The capture of the fort received much praise, but somehow Ethan Allen took most of the credit. This was just the first of several incidents where Arnold had a disagreement with a fellow officer. By the end of the year, Arnold lost his command of Ticonderoga, resigned his commission in the Massachusetts militia, and joined the Continental Army.
But wait, afterwards, Arnold gained the attention of George Washington, stormed Quebec City, was promoted again to Brigadier General in the Continental Army, and was able to take full command of an army? That's his third promotion in a year? And then Burgoyne arrived with reinforcements driving the rebels from Canada.
When was that, Marshal?
Let me check the website. The attack on Quebec was during the winter of 1775-76, and Burgoyne arrived in April 1776. Oh, that's just months before Valcour.
Do you know what else happened before Valcour?
The Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. So all that fighting took place before the rebels even declared independence?
That's right. Continental Congress even extended what they called the Olive Branch Petition in an attempt to make peace with the king. But by July 1776, they believed their differences to be irreconcilable.
That really changes things.
Right. And with Arnold's defeat in Canada, the rebels were on the defensive. In early 1776, Arnold retreated to Whitehall, where he received orders to construct a navy, which will later meet Carleton at Valcour.
Oh, now I understand where we are. It is the fall of 1776. The Americans have maintained control of Ticonderoga. Carleton returns to Quebec, and Burgoyne is on a ship to London.
Burgoyne is a troubled soul. The situation with Carleton in Quebec and his wife's death became a turning point for him. Should he give up on a promotion and retire? Or go for the glory and honor of an experienced military leader? At any rate, it would do nothing for him to remain in Canada for the winter. Here's what Burgoyne had to say.
You will not wonder, my dear friend, at my return to England. A secondary station in a secondary army is at no times agreeable. Many circumstances combine to render it in the present instance uncommonly dissatisfactory. A few duties yet remaining to the memory of Lady Charlotte compel me to break through the bars of ice and snow which are forming to seclude the country from the rest of the globe for the next 6 months. I mean not, however, to withdraw myself from the American war unless a French one breaks out.
Hear that? That's how dicey it is for England and the colonies around the world. They were stretched thin. They had armies around their worldwide empire, and war could erupt anywhere.
My prospects are closed. Interest, ambition of life is over. Profession and honor are all that remains, and I would rather than finished in a professional grave than to slow, wasting decrepitude and infirmness of age.
A professional grave? Does that mean a soldier's grave?
Yes, I think so, because after he tended to the burial of his wife, Lady Charlotte, he spent the next month grieving and pulling himself together. But also, he prepared a plan for the 1777 campaign he called Thoughts for Conducting War from the Side of Canada. It was a three-pronged attack with the aim of severing New England from the remainder of the colonies. It's like what you would do with an infected arm or leg.
Ew, Grandpa!
Well, that's kind of how the British saw the rebellion. An infection that had to be dealt with before it spread. It was a three-pronged attack. Burgoyne's plan. You ready?
Ready.
You see, while Carleton and Burgoyne drove the rebels from Canada in the spring of 1776, British General Sir William Howe had secured New York Harbor. So now the British held the two ends of the waterway that separated New England from the rest of the continent. Prong one, Howe was to come up the Hudson from New York City. Prong two, Burgoyne leads a contingent down from Canada by the way of the Champlain-Hudson Corridor.
That's why we're here.
Prong three, Brevetted General St. Leger was to lead the divisionary force from the west by the way of the St. Lawrence and Mohawk Rivers. Burgoyne's plan was not necessarily original or cutting edge, but Burgoyne convinced Lord George Germain, the man who controlled the British strategy in North America. Germain and the king thought that he was the guy with the fire, ambition, and know-how to get it done. You see, wars were expensive, and the king wanted the rebellion put down within the year. Burgoyne's plan was approved.
One question.
What?
What happened to Carleton? I thought he was in charge in Canada.
Oh, it's also diplomatic. Here is a bit of a letter from Lord George Germain to General Sir Guy Carleton.
March 26, 1777. With a view of quelling the rebellion as soon as possible, the security and good government of Canada absolutely requires your presence there. It is the King's determination to leave about 3,000 men under your command for the defense and duties of that province, and to employ the remainder of your army upon two expeditions under the command of Lieutenant General Burgoyne, who is to force his way to Albany, and the other under the command of Lieutenant Colonel St. Leger, who is to make a diversion on the Mohawk River.
Carleton had to stay and rule in Quebec City. He couldn't lead a campaign. The letter went on to specify that Burgoyne and St. Leger act independently until they relieve their command to Howe in Albany.
It is His Majesty's pleasure that they act as exigencies may require, and in such manner as they shall judge most proper for making an impression on the rebels and bringing them to obedience. But that in doing so, they must never lose view of their intended junctions with Sir William Howe as their principal object.
Must never lose their view equals get to Albany by all means necessary.
Grandpa, why are you making such a big deal of that?
Well, here's what Carleton had to say in regard to Germain.
It was the height of arrogance and folly for ministers in London to direct operations of war in a country at 3,000 miles distance, of which they have so little knowledge as not to be able to distinguish between good, bad, or interested advice, or to give positive orders upon matters which from their nature are ever on the change.
Good point. 3,000 miles is a long way away to try to run a war.
Especially when it takes several weeks to cross the ocean.
We've talked about Arnold, but what about George Washington? Has he crossed the Delaware by now?
Yes, a lot has been going on south of here while Burgoyne is back in London during the winter of 1776-77. General George Washington and the Continental Army pulled off two surprise attacks during the Battle of Princeton and Trenton. On the British side, General Howe has written several letters to Germain outlining different plans for his intentions of the 77 campaign. Howe was going to go after Washington and capture Philadelphia, home to the Continental Congress. After what he believed would be a swift defeat, Howe would then assist Burgoyne.
Howe must be a superhero to win Philly and get back up the Hudson River to meet Burgoyne in Albany, especially in olden times. Did the guy have a map?
Some kind of map, I'm sure, but I don't know if that meant he could actually perceive the distances or understand the challenges of the geography. Also, I'm not sure Albany was at the top of his list.
I thought you said that Germain was the guy who was calling the shots, not Howe.
Germain approved both Burgoyne's plan to act upon the Hudson River and Howe's plan to act upon Philadelphia.
Pretty wacky, but Burgoyne has the green light to proceed with a plan, right?
Righto! The game is on!